After the reading yesterday, I was recollecting some of the other aspects of that particular winter retreat. In those days, the winter retreat was only 2 months long rather than 3 months, so it would have been January and February of 1986. And the routine we had was, and this was in, I remind you, this was in the era when Lumpur Sumedho just benevolently dictated what happened rather than did a lot of discussion. So the morning bell was at 3 o'clock and had a group practice every day till 11 o'clock in the evening. So three in the morning till 11 at night every day. As one of the Ajahn's pointed out, yeah, you did get a bit of a break after the meal though. So there was that. So it was that was part of the that sort of very aggressively ardent, shall we say, approach to Dharma practice. But at the end of the retreat, as I think I mentioned yesterday, after that was done, and a little while later, Lumpur said, "I didn't really like the result of that. It didn't have a good effect. I mean, people could do it, but also there was a few casualties along the way, and also just that sense of the kind of macho, get out there and smash the defilements in the teeth kind of attitude. He thought this is just not very helpful for people, and so that he didn't do that again. That was, but it was a very good example of an acharya with people with great faith and commitment and diligence following the guidance of the acharya. But then the acharya also looking at the results and say, okay, what's the effect of doing it this way? That quality of vimamsa, or looking at the results of what you do, and coming to the conclusion, no, it's not helpful. Didn't really benefit people that much. That particular retreat, we had the retreat center shrine room we used as our meditation hall. The temple didn't exist in that era, so we used the retreat center shrine room, and the rooms in the vihara were so cold that I tended to spend most, I was doing the sitter's practice, so I wasn't lying down to sleep. And so I would just stay in the meditation hall, and most nights I would just lean against one of the night storage heaters. I got a very friendly relationship with a night storage heater. We got that was, and I would just lean up against that until 3 a.m, and and then the next day would begin. So it was a kind of heroic, pioneer spirit to it, but it was also not very sustainable. And as I said, Lumpur himself said, no, it wasn't a very good result of that. So the next section is called delegation. So that means sharing responsibility and sharing duties. Delegation. An important element of Lumpur's efforts to create a strong Sangha was his policy of delegating authority. In the Vinaya texts, the appointment of, quote, officers of the Sangha, unquote, requires a short ceremony to be performed at a formal meeting of the Sangha. At Wat Pho Phong, it was more relaxed, and that's generally the case, that it's very, very rare in my experience that in any monastery they have a sort of formal Pali procedure for appointing someone like the guest officer or the stores officer or the work officer. The Navakama is the name for the work monk. Navakama, the new stuff, literally means new things. Maker of new things, Navakama. So it's very rare for that to be any kind of formal appointment. Lumpur would simply announce that he was appointing such and such a monk to take on specific responsibilities. To act as the monastery secretary or storekeeper, to look after the cloth cupboard, to take responsibility for assigning lodgings, or in later days, to oversee the electricity supply. Monks were chosen on the basis of their competence for the particular task and were cautioned to perform their duties diligently and impartially, free from bias caused by greed, aversion, delusion, and fear. So those four qualities are called the four agati, or biases: greed, aversion, delusion, and fear. So the dosa, moha, and bhaya is fear. As monks became more senior, Lumpur required them to give Dhamma talks and sent many of his most trusted disciples away to establish branch monasteries. In 1979 and in 1981, he spent the Rains Retreat elsewhere, partly in order to give his designated successor, Achen Liam, and other senior monks experience in running Wat Pa Phong in his absence. This proved a prescient move, as it enabled the monastery to adapt remarkably well when Lumpur became seriously ill and unable to continue as abbot from late 1981 onwards. Lumpur sought to encourage his disciples to contribute to the welfare of the community in whatever way they could. Everyone had something to offer. Lumpur is speaking here. It's like the trees at Wat Pa Phong. Every one of them is of benefit. The small trees, the big trees, the short and the long, and the bent. All are useful if we know how to select the right one for the job in hand. Lumpur would often comment on how other forest monasteries had drastically declined after the death of the abbot. This was always a danger when the loyalty and devotion of the monks was almost exclusively focused on the teacher, while the fostering of a sense of community and loyalty to the monastery itself was neglected. Lumpur did not want this to happen at Wat Pa Phong. Giving the monks responsibilities gave them experience, self-confidence, and above all, a sense of participation and belonging. Lumpur spoke often of respect for the Sangha and how the welfare of the Sangha must always take precedence over that of the individual. Nevertheless, when he felt that the Sangha had overstepped its authority or behaved unwisely, he would provide an admonishment. One such occasion occurred when the disquiet felt by many members of the Sangha at the behaviour of one of the senior monks reached a tipping point. The monk in question was one of the more eccentric figures at Wat Pa Phong. He was known for his love of chanting and for his bubbly, sometimes slightly manic, outgoing personality. His behaviour, especially towards lay supporters, was considered by many monks to be undignified and inappropriate. Matters came to a head when, in the absence of Lumpur, the Sangha convened a meeting to discuss the monk's behaviour and, after a vote, decided that he should be formally censured. The monk accepted the Sangha's decision with good grace, but was deeply hurt. He insisted that he had no bad intentions, it was just that every now and then he forgot himself. Everyone awaited Lumpur's return and his decision on how to proceed. On the evening of his return, the Sangha gathered below Lumpur's kuti. He listened in silence to the account of the Sangha meeting. Then, without asking any questions, without hearing the accused monk give his side of the story, he began to give a Dhamma talk. He spoke about how character traits varied. Even the great arahants had different habits and personalities, the result of karma they created in the past, which were unconnected with defilement and remained after enlightenment. He mentioned Venerable Sariputta, who had previously been born as a monkey for many lifetimes, and as a result, every now and again, acted in an eccentric, almost monkey-like fashion, most famously by occasionally jumping over puddles. The Venerable Sariputta, very demure and restrained, was occasionally a puddle jumper. Differences of personality were also seen amongst those still striving to cleanse their minds of defilement. There were those of a predominantly lustful temperament, those with a negative, fault-finding mentality, and those with a slow and dull disposition. There were those given to thought and worry, those with a devout temperament, and those with a naturally intelligent disposition. And there's Lumpur speaking here. The differences between these character types are superficial. Ultimately, they're all one and the same. They're all equally impermanent, unsatisfactory, and selfless, all ungraspable. Like a lemon, a chili, sugar cane, and boropet. Boropet's a very bitter vine that's used for medicinal treatments and as an aid to digestion. Just like a lemon, a chili, sugar cane, and boropet, all these things are born of the earth, but their flavor is different. The lemon has a sour flavour, the chili is hot, the sugar cane is sweet, and boropet is bitter. Their unity lies in the fact that once born of the earth, they all have to die. Lumpur's teacher, Lumpu Tongrat, was acknowledged as a monk of high attainments, but was never greatly a loved figure. He could be rude and aggressive, and act in eccentric ways. Many people thought he was crazy. This, again, this is Lumpur Chah speaking. On one occasion, the villagers, I don't know whether they did it on purpose in order to provoke him or what, they put a live fish in his bowl. They'd only just caught it, and it was still tied up in jute twine. He received it in his bowl, and then took it down to a stream and released it. He said to the fish, "Well, it's better, my child, than if they'd killed you." When he died, his only possession was a razor. He had no other possessions. At his funeral, a strong wind blew up and it poured with rain just for a moment and then stopped, just enough to see that it was a marvel. The reasons that I told you stories like this is so that all of you may see that sometimes strangeness is not so strange at all. It's normal. Lumpur admonished the Sangha for making too much out of a minor matter. Their efforts should be put into developing the path of practice, not into finding fault with each other. There were always going to be monks whose behaviour was not particularly inspiring. And again, Lumpur is speaking. Don't let your feelings of satisfaction or dissatisfaction be your criteria. If you do that, you'll be elevating your moods above the Dhamma. Whatever you do, you must be circumspect. Use your wisdom faculty. Some things will be too small, some too big, some to your liking and some not. But if the matter doesn't involve transgression of the vinaya, then you should be able to let it go. Monks should not waste their times in meaningless disputes. And again, Lumpur is speaking. It's like the two monks who started arguing about when the sun is closest to the earth. One said in the morning because that's when it's biggest. The other said at noon because that's when it's hottest. They went to ask the teacher to adjudicate and he said, "Go and eat your lunch." So I can speak from personal experience that that monk who was admonished for that, he was indeed eccentric. When I was living at Wat Bapong, he was one of the three senior monks just below Lumpur Chah. Lumpur Chah was away in the west at that time. And he was kind of eccentric and outspoken, and he did love chanting, and he was in charge of training the novices, and when he was having a chanting session with the novices, you could hear it from quite a long way away. he was a very sort of kind but extrovert, outgoing character. But as it says here, you know, he was innocent and had no bad intentions, but he would forget himself. And he was a very, very dear fellow. So actually, after he died, I went to his the preparations for his funeral. I couldn't actually make it to the funeral, but I went to his little place in Kanchanaburi where he'd been staying. So particularly because I wanted to pay respects, because he was one of the senior monks in my early years, and I wanted to just sort of go and put my head on the floor to offer my respects and gratitude for him. But also, it was quite clear that he could be annoying to the people around him. The other two senior monks, Lumpur Liam and Lumpur Bun Chu, were extraordinarily quiet and restrained. So that the three of them, after Lumpur Cha, it was Ajahn Liam, Ajahn Chu, and Ajahn Kampong, were the three. So you hardly ever got a peep out of Ajahn Liam or Ajahn Chu. Ajahn Liam was in charge of the stores, and Ajahn Chu was in charge of the kutis, the accommodations. And they were very, very quiet, very restrained, hardly ever showed any kind of emotion or any kind of affect at all. And they were both notoriously sort of stingy. You know, if you wanted to, Ajahn Pasno would talk about how when he lived at Wat Bapong, you'd end up smelling quite bad because you were afraid to go and ask Ajahn Liam for a bar of soap. Or if you went to ask for some soap, he'd kind of go, "No, you don't need any." Or he went to ask for a box of matches, and Lumpur Liam gave him three matches. The story that Lumpur Sumedho tells about when he hit a tree, he lost his temper with a monk and got so angry. My understanding is that was following a discussion with Ajahn Chu about accommodations that Lumpur Sumedho very reasonably had an idea that a different kuti would be better for him, and he put this case to Ajahn Chu, and Ajahn Chu absolutely refused to let him change to a different kuti, and so Lumpur Sumedho's fuse was not quite long enough on that occasion. But he said, "I didn't hit Ajahn Chu; I hit a tree instead." So anyway, Ajahn Kompong, this monk who was talked about here, who was very, very different character, very expressive and outgoing and very gregarious. He was very ready to chat with the visiting lay people or to looking after the novices, and so a completely different character. But I think Lumpo Cha's point was that, he's a different character, different personality, but that's always been the case. And from the time of the Buddha, you had the different arahants, the different disciples of the Buddha had very different characteristics and different personalities, and even with arahatship, those things didn't go away at all. And so that the as he said, that Venerable Sariputta was prone to skipping over puddles on the alms round. Apparently, that particular facet of Venerable Sariputta's life didn't make it through to Sri Lanka. And that when this was mentioned in a Dhamma talk a year or two ago, someone from Sri Lanka was extremely upset. Was very wounded by the idea that Sariputta could be skipping over puddles. And so I said, "Well, you know, this is what I've heard from my teacher. I'll try and look up the reference for you." But it's something that is very well known in Thailand, is often used as an example of what is called vasana, the sort of residual tendencies. And so those qualities and also personal attributes, they carry on even with enlightenment. So that I think a few weeks ago I was mentioning how there's many, many Dhamma talks in the canon given by Sariputta, but there's almost no, I don't think there's a single Dhamma talk given by Venerable Mahamoggallana. He wasn't he had great psychic powers, but he was not a Dhamma teacher. So that there are no talks given by Mahamoggallana. There's some dialogues or conversations with him or events that he's part of, but not any kind of discourses. So he wasn't a very articulate person, it seems, but had great psychic powers. Sariputta had no psychic powers. He was a very gifted meditator, but he was extremely articulate and had an amazingly analytical mind. Similarly, the elder monk Mahakasapa was a great ascetic. He really loved the Dutanga practices and was sort of worshipped austerity and hardship. And so that became, even when he was an arahant, that carried on. So he was always known as one who was wearing rag robes or had very few possessions and so forth. So speaking about Lungpu Tongrat, there are many, many, many stories about him. One of which is when he died, he sent a message out to the local villagers saying, "Oh, there's going to be a special Dhamma talk. You know, if you want to come and hear, then this Thursday night will be a good night to come. So, you know, if you want to hear a special Dhamma talk, then show up." And he actually died on the Dhamma seat as he was giving the talk. He could feel his faculties fading, and he's apparently sort of leaned against the back and sort of lay down against the side. And then finally, sort of lying on his side on the Dhamma seat, he said, "Okay, that's enough," and then died. Well, all the local villagers gathered around him, so didn't want to make a big fuss, but okay, gather everyone together, say goodbye. So there's many, many Lumpu Tongrat stories. Also, speaking of fish, one of the ones that that carries on is that the standard in the forest monasteries when you go out on alms round, and Ajahn Chah's monastery is very very strict in this, is that you wouldn't keep any of the food that you were given in the village. You could keep the sticky rice that came into your bowl. You would make up a ball of sticky rice and keep it in your bowl. But all of the other food, which might be like a head of sweet corn or some green beans or a roasted fish or something, that would all be given up, and that would go into large dishes, and then either the lay people or the novices, whoever was the sort of junior people looking after the kitchen, would then divide things up into equal shares. So you were definitely not allowed to keep anything that landed in your bowl other than rice. And so there's a story of one morning at Ajahn Tongrat's monastery. I think the young Ajahn Chah was there. I think he described it from his own experience. And so that they're all sitting there before the food has been passed out. And so everyone's got, all the monks are in a line, and inside the bowl you've got the ball of sticky rice. And then the rest of the food is sort of sitting there in pots and dishes, and would be handed out by some of the monks in equal way to the rest of the Sangha. So before the food was passed out, Ajahn Tongrat got up, walked down the line, lifted the lid off one monk's bowl, took his ball of sticky rice and cracked it open, and there was a fish inside. Oh, look at that, one got away, you know. Yeah, amazing you didn't notice that when you were making up your ball of sticky rice. You know. And then just put it back together and put it in his bowl, and then the monk had to then deal with his feelings as to that having been having been caught in the act of not being able to give up a particular tempting item from the alms round. But this is also this kind of thing where people sort of decide that a certain member of the Sangha is, their behaviour is really bad, and that particularly if the elder, the senior person, is away or is not to be consulted, hasn't been consulted, then I'd known Lumpur Sumedho do a very similar thing as is described here with Lumpur Cha and Ajahn Kampong, when Lumpur Sumedho was away travelling, and there was one particular novice in the community had managed to annoy a very large proportion of the rest of the community. And so there had been this sort of a lot of discussion and what would happen and how this person should be handled or how should be treated. And it's rather like with this, there was some sort of, not exactly a formal meeting. I was a very junior monk at that point, but I don't think there wasn't a formal Sangha gathering, but a lot of conversation between the more senior people about how, you know, this novice was really bad and really wrong and shouldn't be doing this, that and the other. And had sort of formed into this collective view that was quite firmly inked in and was a kind of group understanding. And so when Lumpur Sumedho came back from his travels and people went to pick him up from the airport, then I think I was in the vehicle as well, but it's 40 years ago, so it's hard to remember. And they sort of were telling Lumpur, oh, you know, he did this and he did that, he did this, he did that, he did this, he did that. And so Lumpur Sumedho was notably quiet, and he might well have been remembering, he said, you know, this has a this has a familiar ring to it, you know, that people finding fault with this particular person and filling his ears with all of this other person's bad behavior. And so that experience that Lumpur Sumedho had of living in community for a long time, you know, 10, 15 years at that point, he had that sense of, well, let's just wait and see, let's wait till I have a chance to talk to this other person, this particular novice, and see if they've got a different picture. And so it was very notable that he handled it very, very similar to the way that is described here with Lumpur Cha, so that then he came back and got settled in, and after a few days, and then it kind of became noticeable where people had stopped using the honorific, or stopped calling this person venerable, but just were using his Pali name. And we began to notice that Lumpur Sumedho was very definitely saying venerable this and venerable that, and quite deliberately using the honorifics, so that you could tell, he hasn't sort of picked up the same view as everybody else. And then when we did have a Sangha meeting, and he spoke to the whole group, then it was very, very similar to the tone that Lumpur Cha had of saying, you know, that yeah, people have been upset by this and that behavior, and that this seems out of place, but you know, that there are individual differences in people, and that also the forming of factions and kind of demonizing a person without the sort of reference to their teacher or to the elder, and just getting lost in your own particular, perspective, So yeah, that's never going to bring a good result. That's not going to lead towards cohesion and a benefit for the Sangha. And so it was very memorable. It was in my early days at Chithurst, probably about 1980 that occurred. And so it really impressed me with, because I had only just met Lumpo Sumedho about a few months before. So this incident happened a few months after I'd arrived, and I thought, wow, it was really, really impressive to see how he was not just sort of pulled in by people's feelings, but he really took a step back and took in the whole picture. And he also recognized, yeah, that novice's behavior was pretty bad in some respects, and yeah, it was worthy of criticism, but he, that sense of not being swept up by the, yeah, he did this and another thing, yeah, let me tell you, and he was very cool and spacious in respect to that. And that was really touching to me, and I felt that, oh, this Ajahn Sumedho really is something different. he's got the human qualities and the qualities of a really skillful leader that I hadn't really seen before. So it was very very inspiring, very beautiful to see how he handled that. Yes.
That doesn't mean that there is no discrimination to be made on people's behavior, or there is no collective wisdom, or that anything goes.
Oh no! It's more to do with that kind of group energy. You know, that things, people get stirred up and see things in a particular way, and it's not saying that novice's behavior was pretty, he did some pretty weird and crazy things and ridiculous, and his behavior was not appropriate in many respects. But what Lumpo was doing was to say, notice how there's a kind of ganging up against this person, and that person's good qualities are not being recognized. Also, you didn't wait until I got back from my travels before you all acted. So similar with Ajahn Chah, and it was pointing towards that quality of reactivity. So it's not just glossing over someone's bad behavior, but seeing that reactivity or how people can feed on each other's and another thing, yeah, right, absolutely, you get a kind of vortex going, and that's not a trustworthy energy. And so what I found was most impressive with Lumpo Sumedho, he wasn't pretending that novice's behavior was good, but he was in a sense not swept up in that same vortex, and that the unskillful behavior can be addressed and that person can be given feedback, but look at this sense of demonizing that person, and that a sense of losing perspective, and that so that because by the time that Lumpo Sumedho had returned, it was kind of like that novice couldn't do anything right. It was like everything was wrong about him. And it just sort of got so slanted that he said, well, and Lumpo would say, don't forget, he has actually taken the precepts, and he shaves his head and wears the ochre robe. He has actually had the intention to be a good person. And that, he's made these mistakes, but there are some skillful qualities in there as well. So it was very, very helpful. And just in that way of really responding to a situation rather than reacting. So there's that quality of an openness and say, well, let's look at the whole picture. And so then where there was unskillful behavior, that could be addressed and acknowledged, but that aspect of refusing to see any kind of redeeming features in that person, that's what he was... So going against, or forgetting the fact that person had gone forth and had made commitments to training, and what wholesome qualities there were being completely sort of shoved out of the picture. and that the and like Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Samedho functions in a very intuitive sense, that and feeling that kind of reactive, demonizing energy, then he just, well, wait a minute, let's get more of the whole picture. And so, as it turned out, that novice became a bhikkhu, and then has continued to create all kinds of headaches many years since, so without mentioning names, but that so that the bad behavior didn't come to an end, but that example of how to work with that aspect of things in the sangha, I thought was a really, really good example. It made a big impact, and I think that quality of when someone's very excited about something, oh God, this is a great idea for a project, Ajahn. This is amazing. It's so good. You go, okay, thank you for sharing. Well, let's just see what other people think about it. And they say, oh yeah, Anejo, he's got this completely crazy idea. He's totally obsessed with this thing. He thinks it's this wonderful idea. The rest of us think he's completely lost the plot. Oh, okay. Thank you for sharing. So that sense of taking in the whole picture and is really important within community life. And it's certainly not the case that anything goes, but that taking the time to take in to appreciate the whole picture, or as much of the picture as can be appreciated, that's a really important thing. I don't know how many times over the years, particularly if you're in a position of leadership, people come up to you and say, Ajahn, I can't believe it, do you know what he's done now? And you can feel the sense of being pulled by a current, so it takes a lot of effort to have that sense of, okay, I receive your feelings of upset and your irritation or your excitement or whatever it might be, or someone's sadness, someone's really, really grief-stricken, they're really tearful. So yes, you appreciate what they're feeling, but also that sense of, yes, I receive your and acknowledge your feeling or your perspective, but also I'm not taking that to be the whole picture. And that in the leadership roles in the Sangha, as time goes by, if you stick around long enough, then you'll get plenty of that exercise. That it's very much a part of living in a group, and that people's enthusiasms or their fears or their kind of conflicts and their sadnesses and crises and so on, it's really an aspect of the middle way, being completely receptive to and appreciating someone's really upset or they're really excited, or I appreciate this is really important to you, but let's consider how much it's going to cost, or who else is going to be affected by that, or I can see that you're enthusiastic about that idea, or that you're really worried about that, but let's just wait and see. So one of the most helpful phrases in Sangha life is, let me think about it. So you can note that down. Any of you heading towards leadership, let me think about it. So you're not saying, you're totally out of your mind, what are you talking about? It's just, let me think about it. I mean, the thinking about it might take 3.5 seconds. But it's, you can be quite honest and to say that. Say, let me think about it. So you're not pushing someone away and saying, get over it, or that's a crazy idea, or just rejecting someone. You're receiving where they're at, but you're not buying into what they're excited about or frightened of or sad about or grieving over. Very helpful. Let me think about it. Can I get back to you on that? Skillful means, upaya. Any other questions on that section?
Go back a little bit. What the result when you non-sleeping practice for 3 years?
Not sleeping? Well, I slept, but I just didn't lie down.
Not lying down, yeah.
Quite a few results. One, after a few months, there is no comfortable position. So you stop looking for one. At first, you're trying to find a way to be comfortable. So there's a lot of dukkha in that. But after a period of time, there's no comfortable position. Everything aches most of the time. So you stop looking for the comfortable place. So that's quite peaceful. You have to develop a lot of virya, because as soon as anything gets quiet, as soon as you sit down in meditation, then tend to doze off. During that period, I never used a zafu, I never used that. I thought, zafus are for wimps. I was looking flat on the floor only. So then one of the junior nuns offered me one of the nicer zafus, and she came up and said, "This is for you." And I wasn't an ajahn then. I was, "This is for you, Tanamura." I said, "Oh, I don't need it." She said, "I think you do." She was getting seasick watching me kind of nodding through. Because we were all in the retreat center shrine room. We were all sort of in the shrine room together and sort of like in a sort of semicircular format. So she was getting seasick watching me nodding all the time. So she very politely offered me a zafu. So you develop a lot of virya just to sort of keep alert, so that was helpful. I found that it really works best in a when you're doing a lot of formal practice. So that the couple of years I was at Harnam Monastery, particularly in the, like when we had the winter retreats at Harnam, then it was extremely supportive to the meditation, because you're just doing sitting and walking all day long. There's only about five or maybe four or five people in the community. And we would get, there was so much snow on the, there was so much snow and ice around, there was very few visitors. So it was extremely quiet and a lot of formal practice all day long. So doing the sitter's practice, I found that I would be up until 11 or midnight, quite alert, and then I'd lean against the wall. And sometimes I'd wake up at like 2:30 or 3. I just didn't need much sleep. And even when you slept, the sleep would be quite shallow, because the system didn't need that much sleep. And sometimes you even, like, you're awake as you're asleep. You could hear you could feel your body breathing in the sleep state, and you're awake, but your body's sleeping sometimes. So that really showed me, okay, the sitter's practice is really most effective and genuinely directly supportive of meditation in an environment of a lot of formal practice. Then after 2 years at Harnam, then I came here in the summer of 85. So then for about 18 months, I did the sitter's practice here, and that was more of an endurance test. Because I was monastery secretary and guest monk, and just interacting with people a lot and doing a lot of physical work, so that was more of a survival, and the sitter's practice was kind of developing a lot of resolution and patience, but it didn't really help the bhavana, the actual concentration and insight. The mind was very easily going to dull states. But you did develop a lot of patience, that you found you just couldn't get irritated with anything, and you stopped looking for the comfortable place, as I said. So that was helpful. I think also the attachment to looking good in the meditation hall, when you know that you're drooping, occasionally drooling as well as drooping, saliva dripping out of your mouth. You know, if you're vain about how good you look, you want to kind of look like a Buddha image in a meditation hall, it's very good for that. And I had vanity problems. So I was tended to be quite vain, so knowing that I was not looking at all impressive in the meditation hall, that was helpful. I did develop a lot of barometer in that respect, just the patience, resolution, energy. It was very, very helpful. Very helpful. It's not for everybody. And also, it was at the end of 1986, so coming up to the winter retreat at the beginning of 87, that was when I went to Lumpur Samedo and said I was going to give up doing the Siddhas practice and a lot of other ascetic practices that I was doing as well. And I've mentioned many times how I expected Lumpur Samedo to say, "Oh well, you know, well done, lad. You know, you've given it a good shot. You know, if you have to sort of pack it in, then that's okay." But his immediate reaction, as soon as I told him, was he said, "Good, about time." You know? And it really shook me. You know, like it was, like he was waiting for me to be sensible, you know, to wake up. And like the conversation we were having yesterday about moderation and how the mind is the most important thing, that Lumpur could see that I was really attached to sort of being an ascetic or being a super monk or trying to be good at everything and be kind of worshipping hardship for its own sake. And there was so he was putting out signals a few times during that period that I didn't get. So in those days, we all used to eat here in the sala, and the food would be put into our bowls on the servery, and so Lumpur would sit in the middle, and the nuns were down one side, the monks were down the other side, and so on one occasion, I was sitting next to him, so he was in the middle, and I was just next to him, and he handed me this Danish pastry in the lid of his bowl. Of passed it to me, and this sort of gooey Danish pastry with jam and creme pâtissière on it, and very kind of sweet, goopy. And I immediately started passing it on to the next monk, and he said, "No, Tan Amaro, it's for you. I want you to have it." And there was just like, "But you know, I don't have nice things. I'm the monk who never accepts nice things." And he kind of gave me this look like, I want you to have it. Yeah. This is a teaching." and so I didn't quite get the point of that on that occasion, but he was trying to get it across that just making hardship for yourself and worshipping difficulty and that sort of aggressive austerity approach, that's a means to an end. It's not a way of life. It's not something that's intrinsically valuable. And so that I did take the Danish pastry and I ate it, and it was delicious. But I didn't really get the point that he was aiming at until later in that year. And then when we had that exchange, and I said, "I'm going to give up all my ascetic practices," he said, "Oh, good, about time." You know, and I could see he really was waiting for me to get the point that trying to be super monk was not it, and that the attitude of mind is really far more important than the austerities or the tokens of sort of good monastic, the tokens or the sort of the things that display that quality, like what a good practice equals this, bad practice equals that. So that you're doing, so therefore, as many of the good practice things is better, and I was very much in that more asceticism is better. And he was trying to get me to see that was not the point. So that was so part of what I learned from that whole period was that yes, you can do it, but it's only really valuable if it's a means to an end rather than a thing in its own right. Does that make sense? So if you can see all the dutangas, like strictly eating one meal a day, or not lying down to sleep, or any of those things, if you see that it's an upaya, it's a means to an end, then it can really serve you. If you are taking it on as an identity, or as a something that you're seeing as having intrinsic worth, then it becomes an obstacle. Even in the Buddha's time, there were there was stories of monks who were attached to their patchwork robes, and didn't want to give up their rags it's a rag robe, but you're attached to it. So when the Buddha would be pointing to the attachment, it's not the cloth, it's the mind that is the important thing. So I was very, very grateful for Lumpur Sumedho to point that out to me. It's very helpful. But I don't regret having done three and a half years of sitter's practice. Still got knees that work. That's a danger of it, is that you can wreck your knees or your back. But I managed to not do that at that time. Okay, so the next section is called A Well-Rounded Training. And, interestingly enough, the first section, the subsection, is called Putting Forth Effort. One of the foundations of Buddhist practice is the conviction that purposeful effort has meaning. The Buddha rejected the beliefs that human life is determined by a divine will, or fate, or randomness. He proclaimed that human beings created their own life and environment by the quality of their actions of body, speech, and mind. Lumpur's teachings expressed this right view again and again. Monks were to take responsibility for their lives through their own consistent efforts. They all had the potential for liberation within them. The question was whether they had the determination and the patient endurance to realize that potential. And there's Lumpur speaking here. Don't just sit there waiting for Nibbana to come to you. Have you ever seen anyone successful in that way? Wherever you see you're in the wrong, then quickly remedy it. If you've done something incorrectly, then do it again properly. Reflect on experience. There was no alternative to hard work. Again, Lumpur is speaking. Some people become monks thinking that they'll be able to take it easy and enjoy life. But if you've never learned to read, you can't just pick up a book and start to read it. Some people come here to become monks in order to find happiness. But what does happiness arise from? What is its cause? Hardship must come first. Don't you have to work before you have the money to buy food? To farm the land before you get rice to eat? Hardship precedes happiness. One phrase in particular monks heard again and again over the years. Again, this is Lumpur speaking. Eating little, sleeping little, talking little. These are the actions of the practitioner. Eating a lot, sleeping a lot, talking a lot. These are the actions of the fool. So going back to that first part about effort, so that's one of the frequently expressed aspects of the teaching, particularly when the Buddha is meeting with wanderers of different groups and spiritual groups, or people were asking him about his particular approach. So some spiritual groups had the idea that everything is preordained by a divine power, that the Brahma or some divine power dictates the pattern of our lives, and it's like a fixed, determined pattern. Others had the belief that things were random, and that there was no results in any kind of long-term or substantial way of our actions or our attitudes. Others had the view that you should be as passive as possible. Peace comes from passivity, from non-action, from non-doing. And so there's numerous different discourses where the Buddha's talking about the kind of views and opinions and different spiritual approaches that different groups had. There's dozens and dozens of them. Just in the Brahmajala Sutta, the first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, there's 62 kinds of view are outlined that people had. So, but particularly in respect to effort, the Buddha made it clear that the path that he described was a path of effort. The teaching he described was a path of doing. It involved action, and that our actions make a difference. There is action and there's a result of action. So over and over and over again, he made that. And that's why, say, we use the expression the Eightfold Path. It's a path, so it's got a direction. There's a doing. And so that it's not passivity of trying to do nothing or being carried along by a divine power, but rather the individual can make choices, and those choices make a difference. And that frequently, it's much more common from Asian visitors rather than Western visitors, but there's often a kind of, you get it from both sides of the world as well, there's a kind of view of things being predetermined, or that it was meant to be. So that is absolutely not in accordance with Buddha Dhamma. There's no meant to be. Things might have a tendency to happen in a particular way, but nothing is fixed. So it's a bit of an alarm button when someone says, "It was meant to be, Ajahn." I find one of my eyebrows raising. I think, that's not the way the Buddha talked about it. And so that people can be very fatalistic, that they're stuck with a particular kind of karma. It's got to be this way. I can't get away from this. It's inescapable. And often also people are asking for strings to be tied on their wrists or to be sprinkled so that they'll have good luck and so forth. So one of the things that Dhompu Cha would say, and is reflected here, and I also say very frequently myself, is that in terms of Buddha Dhamma, we make our own luck. It's not just you're not just swept along or the expression that Lumpur Sumedha would use, we're not helpless victims of fate, but we make our own luck, that the choices that are made make a difference. So sometimes things have a very strong inclination in a particular direction, and so there can be strong tendencies, but still what we do with those tendencies, the choices that we make around those tendencies or those habits, that's up to the power of the mind moment by moment, so that it really puts the responsibility into your own hands, so that in many ways it reflects how Buddha Dhamma is a religion for taking responsibility. It's not you're not like a little child just sort of being told what to do or being led here and led there, or hoping that mummy or daddy in the sky is going to make everything all right. But rather, it puts the responsibility into your own hands. It's up to you. It's the choices you make. So sometimes people say, "It's all going to be all right in the end, isn't it, Ajahn?" And so I say, "Well, we're all going to be one with the Dhamma in the end, aren't we? Or we're all going to get to Nibbana eventually." So, well, if you follow the Buddha's teaching in the Pali Canon, that's not the case. What is the case is if you do the right thing, you will. That Nibbana will be realized. If you don't do the right thing, it won't. It's not just a happily ever after. We're all going to go to heaven in the end. It's like, well, that's not the teaching. The teaching that you have in the Pali Canon is that it depends completely on the choices that we make moment by moment. There's no guarantee. The northern Buddhist world, you have things like the Lotus Sutra say that all beings will become Buddhas, but that's not to be found anywhere in the Pali Canon. It's not a teaching out of the southern school, but rather, if you do the right things, Nirvana will be realized and rebirth can end. If you don't do the right things, then it won't, and samsara is endlessness. So it carries on, which is challenging when people want to be, tell me it's all going to be all right, daddy. kiss it better and make it all right. So it's not very comforting, but it's very realistic. So it's challenging to us that that little child in us that wants to be reassured and told us, you know, everything's going to be all right. But I feel it's actually kinder to be realistic than to just be giving false comfort. Yes. The responsibility of an arahant. I don't know about responsibility, but I think it depends on individual disposition. But some people who are arahants make themselves available to teach and to be an example. Others take themselves away to live quietly. I'd never really thought of things in those terms. The enlightened mind, free of greed, hatred, and delusion, will function according to different dispositions, the time, the place, the situation, and it'll have its own effects. Well, you have to find an arahant and ask. Okay, maybe I'll any other questions on that? Because the next section is quite long. So, enough for today?
No. Keep going.
The next section is called Patibhadā, and I'll read that tomorrow.